Dr. Andrew Hoffman is the Holcim Professor of Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan. His new book, How Culture Shapes the Climate Change Debate, examines ways in which non-scientific views shape opinion on the subject of global climate shifts. Dr. Kirk Heinze, host of MSU Today's Greening of the Great Lakes, caught up with Andrew Hoffman by phone recently to discuss his work.
The point of the book is that the public and political debate over climate change has morphed, and it is really not about science and CO2 or climate models. It's about values and worldviews, and people are reacting to a whole host of issues that they hear when they hear the words climate change or global warming, for that matter.
And you say at another point they are not really engaging in a scientific debate when the vitriol starts to fly over data and models. You talk a lot about values. Talk about the importance of values and why values are sometimes not incorporated into the dialogue.
Well, for a lot of people, they just think that the scientific community has spoken and the people should just accept it. And a lot of scientists feel that science is not political. It's just data and models. But they say things like the data speak. But science is political. It is inherently social and political when you're asking people to change what they believe or how they behave. And so as people start to push forward for a recognition that we are altering the global climate, that challenges some people's notions about our place within the environment, our importance. Some people find that hubris to think that humans are that powerful. A lot of people distrust scientists. They distrust environmentalists. They distrust democratic politicians, and those are the primary spokesmen on climate change. And so I can go through the host of reasons that are in the book, but the key is that people make sense out of complex issues by using what we call motivated reasoning. And I try not to use too much jargon in the book, but we look at things in a way, if we don't fully understand them, in a way that we seek to confirm our pre-existing worldview. And so if you hear something from someone that you distrust, you're automatically going to distrust them. And if it flies against some values you hold dear, you will resist it. And that's going back to the hate mail. Why would someone send hate mail over something that is seemingly a scientific issue? It's because what they're reacting to, and if you read the hate mail, it's in there, they're reacting to some deeply held beliefs and values that they feel are threatened by a recognition that climate change is real.
Yeah, and I think you do an excellent job of framing the reasons, like the four forms of distrust that you mentioned in the book about why this debate has become so polarizing. You know, it is interesting, though, how often when you're talking to people who are climate change, the anthropogenic climate change advocates, essentially, or believers, will say something like, you know, the scientific debate is over with, as far as I'm concerned. I'm not going to talk to these people anymore. It's just a waste of my time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are extreme positions on both sides of the debate, and unfortunately, they dominate the debate. And so scientists cringe when certain people overstate the science. That doesn't help either. And they also cringe when people totally reject the science. There are certain things that are pretty clear to scientists. There are certain things they're still trying to work out. But that doesn't negate the reality of what they're studying. And I do find it interesting in the public debate. There was a survey by Yale that found that 2/3 of Americans do not talk about climate change with friends and family. And so it seems that climate change is entering the realm of sex, religion, and politics, of things you don't bring up in polite company.
Yeah, at one point, and maybe even towards the end of the book, where if you can't convince the uncle to have a civil discourse on the issue, then maybe it's better to talk football or something at the at the Thanksgiving table. Also, I mean, in addition to framing the reasons why this has become such a divisive issue and why people demonize each other on both sides of the issue, you do a lot with where do we go from here? And you call it a consensus-based path towards more constructive discussion. Take us along the topography of that path a little bit.
Well, we can in the book I lay out, you know, that to get to where I'm going, that when you find yourself engaged with someone who says that climate change is not real, if they have connected it to their personal identity, then giving them more data will only get them to dig the heels in even harder. This is a very surprising and counterintuitive result. So if someone doesn't believe climate change is real, another IPCC report isn't going to change their mind. Because what they're talking about are, you know, fear of big government, distrust of the spokesman, as I said, distrust of the scenarios. I can go through the whole list of what they're reacting to, and it's not the science. And so presenting with more science, they just hear, well, you think I'm an idiot. So we can stop there and say, well, that's the form of the debate, but where can we go from here? And I lay out three approaches. And they really closely mirror the way we think about negotiations and dispute resolution. And so one is the optimistic path, which in negotiations we call the win-win, where we can create a solution where you don't have to change your beliefs at all. Everything will be fine, and the answer there is some killer technology that's going to make energy too cheap to meter, and you don't have to change anything. You can still live the life you've been living and have the beliefs you've had because technology saved the day. You can have the pessimistic path where things break down, where no one will change their beliefs and they expect the other to. And you can think the analogy for that is the abortion debate, where two sides are speaking two different issues, life and choice. Both sides only look for information that confirms their opinion and disconfirms the other, and they even demonize the other. And I call that a cultural schism. And that there are elements of that taking place now. But the third way is, what we teach in negotiations is you move off of positions and focus on interests. That's how you do effective negotiations. Someone makes a stand, you want to dig down. Why? What's the position for that stand? So on climate change, rather than, you know, hammering out, is climate change happening? No, it's not. Yes, it is. You're an idiot. No, you're an idiot. Let's go deeper and say, what are the elements, the underlying elements of the conversation, whether on a personal level, when you find that person across the Thanksgiving table who says that climate change is a hoax, can you dig deeper of what they're thinking or where they're coming from, understand how they're approaching the issue and what the full basis of their resistance is? I have a vignette in the book where I was talking to a friend and he said, you know, he didn't know what I did. He said, what do you do? And I said, well, I teach. And what do you teach? Well, business and environmental issues. And he said, you mean like that climate change? That's not real, is it? And so I said, well, actually, the science is quite compelling. His next question is, are you a Democrat or Republican? And so I said, I'm an independent. And his next question is, what do you think of Al Gore? And I said, honestly, that I think that he called attention to the issue, but unfortunately, perceptions of him made it a partisan issue. It became too connected to Democratic politicians. What he was doing there was trying to figure out whether he trusts me, whether he wants to hear me. And the worst thing I could have done in that situation was start a science lecture or start to lecture him on the car he was leaning up against with the Hemi motor or any one of a number of tracks that would get people to just shut down and say, I'm sorry, I really didn't want to have this conversation and I really resent your tone of zealousness and self-righteousness.
My guest is Dr. Andy Hoffman. He is the Holcim Director, Holcim Professor and Director of the Erb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan. And so, you get to that point where, okay, what is your response then? And one thing that comes through your book, too, the importance of the language that we use when we engage in these kinds of discussions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the words you choose are very important. Let me back up. The book is all, it's a compilation of all the social science out there on this issue. So everything is grounded. The book is like 100 pages, but it has 20 pages of citations. So I'm really trying to bring everything together to give you a dense serving of all the social science that's out there. And there's some interesting social science on what happens when you use global warming and what happens when you use climate change in these conversations. And the majority of the research says that when you're talking to audiences that are liberal and believe that climate change is real, and I should point out that the majority of liberals and Democrats believe climate change is real. The majority of Republicans and conservatives do not. Now, I want to put a caveat on that and that, you know, explain that through motivated reasoning, but we all do it. So where it may be the conservative right that's against the science on climate change, it's actually the liberal left that's against the science on the safety of GMOs. We all do it. You have to reach people with a message that they'll appreciate. And so, as an example, the scientists were going to the Vatican saying, you know, you got to attend to climate change. And they were coming back with a lukewarm response saying that's really about the environment. That really isn't our sweet spot. And then finally people said, well, wait a minute. No, it's not about the environment. It's about social equity because the world's poor are going to get hit first and hardest, and they didn't do it. And that got the church's attention. The Vatican's going carbon neutral right now. And that it illustrates the power of the frames that are out there that you can use. You can talk to people about managing risk. And if there's a low probability, high consequence event, then we take out insurance. You know, the odds of my house burning down are low. The impact on my finances would be devastating. So I take out insurance. And so on climate change, someone may say the probability is low that someone's going to hit, but what if you're wrong? Can we take that hit? The answer is no. What's the insurance? It's technology and behavior change, really trying to do something about this. You can frame it as national security. There's a group of Army generals that has done that, saying this is a threat multiplier that's going to make things more unstable around the world. You can frame it as economic competitiveness. If we don't develop the new technologies and energy and renewable energy, then Germany and China are going to do it, and we're going to buy it from them. One frame that social scientists have found is particularly effective is the health frame, and that if we have weather events related to climate change, in particular extreme heat in urban centers, it's the vulnerable that will get hurt, the senior citizens and the young children. And that resonates for people because, you know, the challenge here is making this personally salient. And you can do that with a health frame because we at least have senior citizens that we care about and probably have children or grandchildren or nieces or nephews that we care about as well.
Well, we're about out of time. I want to mention the book again. It's How Culture Shapes the Climate Change Debate. It is just out by Professor Andrew Hoffman. It's a Stanford University Press brief. I'm 2/3 of the way through it, Andy. It's an outstanding book that I'm going to recommend to many, many people. And it's certainly been a pleasure talking with you.
Oh, it's a pleasure. The pleasure was all mine. Thank you very much.